have a series of interrelated cases this morning growing out of the Reynolds class action. So we'll start with Peterson. Mr. Kirby.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Roger Kirby. I represent Lynn Carnegie in this appeal. Mr. Monahan and Mr. Antrice and I have made an effort to coordinate our arguments. Mr. Monahan will deal with structural flaws concerning adequacy of representation and federalism question. I would like to speak first to the district court's belief that, quote, if the settlement is fair and adequate, then counsel adequately represented the class. Close quotes. That notion, the notion that if the settlement is fair and adequate, then counsel has adequately represented the class, is, we submit, plain legal error. It collides with settled and venerable Supreme Court precedent. Then one must first address adequacy of representation and that it be present at all times. Courts may not reach the issue of the financial adequacy of the settlement before deciding the issue of the adequacy of the class representative. Now, why is this? This court has identified some reasons. 5 years ago in the Bank of Boston case, it observed that there was concern that if the court had not been satisfied regarding the adequacy of the representative, that the proponents of the settlement might, quotes, put one over, close quotes, on the court. 25 years ago, in the General Motors case, this court wrote that a court certainly may reject a settlement, but it cannot undertake the partisan task of bargaining for better terms. The integrity of the process is important. And the Supreme Court has written many times, most recently in Amchem and Ortiz, that the integrity of the process, insofar as assuring oneself that the representative is adequate, is not merely important, but constitutionally essential.
Let me ask you a specific question, please. You've asserted that your clients received both RALs and rapid refunds, but you're challenging only the rapid refund fees.
No,
were the fees charged for the rapid refund related in any way to the fees that were charged for the RALs, or was the fee structure completely different?
Well, we're challenging the fees associated with the RALs, and the fee structure was different for the most part. You paid more for the loan, directly and indirectly, a lot more than for the rapid refund. And a proposition that would be put ultimately to the trier of fact is whether you got anything of substance for paying more. I wanted to add another point as to why it is important first to address adequacy of representation, and that is that if you think about it, the logical implication of allowing a court in the first instance to dispense with the need to address adequacy of the plaintiff or the counsel is that it in effect dispenses with the need for plaintiffs at all. You can simply have defendants say, we've been sued, here's a check for $25 million, we're paying it into the clerk's office, and have the court decide whether that's a financially adequate result. And that's pretty much what happened here. A proponent can offer an affidavit into evidence of an expert saying that it's an appropriate amount, even though that affidavit was not tested by deposition or other cross-examination at a hearing.
numbers were mentioned at that Metropolitan Club meeting?
The numbers mentioned at the Metropolitan meeting were between $20 and $25 million. In Judge Nagel's opinion, he refers to the fact that Mr. Harris, one of the settlement proponents on the plaintiff's side, walked away from the meeting believing that a settlement could be reached in the $24 million range.
Wasn't it just $20 million and then there was a lot of activity or some activity that brought it up to $25 million?
At the Metropolitan Club meeting, there was a variety of testimony and papers submitted concerning the numbers used at the Metropolitan Club meeting. Those numbers ranged between $20 and $25 million. When the settlement proponents first came into court to announce that they had been seriously engaged in settlement talks, the initial number used was $16 million.
Now, were those Schwartz and Prosnitz? Were those the?
Those were two of the three who attended the Metropolitan.
Who was the third?
Mr. Harris.
Oh, Harris was there at the Metropolitan.
Yes, Your Honor. And what was the particularly?
But that was the first time he'd ever been involved. Is that correct?
Didn't
Mr. Prosnitz decide to bring him along that day?
I'm not sure, because there's conflicting testimony as to who decided to bring whom along. But the what is not disputed is that in September of 1997, when this meeting took place, none of those persons had initiated a claim against Beneficial or against Block, that there had been a widespread and active litigation against Beneficial and Block, and that when they, three of them, decided to bring their claims in April of the following years, those claims had a maturity of about a year and a half. Nor is it disputed as a matter of record that by the time the settlement was presented orally, in principle, to the district court, cases throughout the country had advanced to various degrees of success.
Are you saying Ms. Schwartz didn't have a client at that time?
There's record evidence that is consistent with the claim that she does not. She asserts otherwise. But frankly, I don't think the outcome is altered particularly whether one has a client or not. I mean, it's all altered in the hues and in the tones, but it's not altered in the substance of the.
There was no case, even if she had a client. Was
sorry, Your Honor?
She had no case.
She had, was the principal.
She had a client, maybe, but no case. Let me ask you this. Now, this meeting, has this been initiated by the defendants or by Schwartz and Prosnitz?
My understanding from the testimony is that it was initiated by the would-be plaintiff's lawyers.
By Schwartz and Prosnitz.
Correct.
Was this in connection with the settlement of the other case, I forget the name of it. So.
There's a case involving Jackson Hewitt.
Jackson, yeah.
And
wasn't that the ostensible reason for this luncheon?
It was the reason why they were in the same geographic location, because there was two of the three lawyers had known each other from the Jackson Hewitt settlement, which we regarded as cosmetic, and two of the three plaintiff's lawyers had been involved in that, and they'd been involved with the lawyers for Beneficial on the other side who represented the defendant in that case, and so they were in the same place at the same time, and the meeting came about. But I think. And while I do think the meeting is extremely important, I mean, it's a very dramatic event, I don't think that the result of this case, now I'm saying this without meaning to minimize the importance of the meeting, I don't think the result of this case would alter if these plaintiff's lawyers had simply walked into court without this history in April of 1999 or 1998 and started the case as they did, and when they found themselves disarmed to coin the currency supplied by the Amchem decision because they lost the case against Block and because they had their standing substantially curtailed against Beneficial. They were now confined to a case against Beneficial for 4 years. At that point, they were confined, basically, their powers were confined to selling a settlement. And while it's perfectly permissible and not in the least bit dishonorable for lawyers to earn fees, or for any of us in the legal profession to get paid for what we do, everybody in this courtroom is getting paid for what we do, that payment has to be within legal bounds, and legal bounds that are not permitted under logic, doctrine, and underlying constitutional principle are that you have the authority only to sell somebody else's claims. You have no power to negotiate because you have no claims against one defendant. You have claims against only one-third of the period against the remaining defendants, and then you dispose of some claims of being hotly pursued elsewhere.
Now, you mentioned that you didn't have a chance to cross-examine Adler. He was in the hospital, wasn't he? Did you make any effort to stay the proceedings until he got out of the hospital, or what?
We
how seriously did you try try to cross-examine him?
Well, we were very serious about it. We had consent to have his deposition taken. Then he became unavailable because he's in the hospital. We wanted him to appear at the hearing, and we would have examined him live.
Did the district court deny a request for you to do so when he came out of the hospital?
I believe so, but I have a minute on rebuttal. There's somebody who is actually participating in that hearing, and I will confer with him during my sit-down period.
Okay.
I thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Monahan?
Good morning, Your Honors. I represent Ronnie and Nancy Haas, and they are the duly certified class representatives in a Texas class action against Block. In the few minutes that I have, I'd like to make two very general points. The first point is that this settlement is the direct product of a glaring structural flaw concerning adequacy of representation. When the district court began to interfere with the Texas class action, H&R Block faced no monetary liability in the district court, none. The only claims that had been asserted against Block were state law claims, and they were dismissed. H&R Block was therefore effectively out of the district court litigation, and the would-be Illinois class representatives had nothing to threaten H&R Block with in settlement negotiations. Moreover, the Illinois class had been certified for settlement purposes only. As Justice Ginsburg said, these persons so certified are disarmed. I think it's fair to say that the purported class act representatives in this case were not disarmed. They were dead. They had absolutely nothing to threaten Block with, and they appeared at the bargaining table solely because Block had, Lazarus-like, raised them from the dead. And they settled with Block because otherwise they were going to receive no counsel fees. The real participants of the bargaining process were Judge Zagel's ghost on the one hand and the defendants on the other. The defendants had to be satisfied that they had some deal that Judge Zagel would accept.
Is it your argument that the inclusion of the Texas class is enough? Is alone enough to render the settlement invalid because the Texas litigation was more advanced and because Block had been dismissed from the Reynolds case? Is that in a nutshell?
That's the second point I was going to make, Your Honor. The first point is a general point. There was no adequate representation. You can't have adequate representation if you have nothing to bargain with. The second point is the point you make, the federalism point. The district court's judgment and the proceedings that led up to it was a direct product of the court's wholesale interference with other proceedings, particularly the Texas class action. And in our brief, we make a number of specific objections, no personal service, no subject matter jurisdiction, violation of the Anti-Injunction Act. I would want to focus on only one point, broader than any of these points. This case is the reverse of the recent decision of your court in the Mexican money transfer litigation, an opinion written by Judge Easterbrook, and a settlement class approved. There, the dominant thrust of the litigation was based on federal substantive claims. The state law claims were simply tag-along claims, and there was very little variation in the state law claims to begin with. Here, by contrast, the dominant claims in this case are entirely state law claims. Judge Zagel discounted the Tyler claims and doesn't mention the RICO claims. So here you have the jurisdiction conferring claims are extremely weak. This is a state law case. If you look at the original complaint, as a matter of fact, you'll find it very difficult to find H&R Block mentioned in it. It would be a nice Easter hunt for your law clerks.
They're busy enough, Mr. Monahan.
The point I want to make is that there is no federal interest that would justify the judge halting proceedings in not only in Texas but throughout the entire United States, keep the Texas litigants in dark about.
That issue is moot, though, isn't it?
No, it's not, Your Honor. It affects the validity of the settlement. We're not appealing here the injunction issues. They're moot. Although we could never get a panel of your court to pass on it, But what we're appealing here is we're talking about a structural infirmity that affects the entire course of the proceedings, rendering the final judgment defective.
Well, there was federal jurisdiction, I think, was there not? You're just saying that
there was no
state
law
claims were more serious than the federal ones.
Well I'm not
pretty
sure.
Hard to evaluate. But.
Well, I don't think there was federal jurisdiction. I have never seen a case in which Section 1361A was used by the defendants in an offensive manner.
But you're not challenging the decision to include the Texas class. You're challenging the judicial decision to uphold the settlement.
That's right. That's what we're doing here. I think my time is up.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Monahan. Mr. LaTurner?
Good morning. I represent Ms. Peterson, who is the named plaintiff in a certified class action in the Circuit Court of Cook County. The settlement here only releases claims arising out of refund anticipation loans. A refund anticipation loan is a loan from a bank which is disbursed to the taxpayer immediately and repaid by the tax refund to the bank whenever it comes. The definition in this case excludes the Peterson claims which arise out of a rapid refund. A rapid refund involves payment to Block for electronic filing services whereby the IRS processes and pays the refund within 3 weeks. The Peterson claim is that they paid for that service, but Block had previously been told by the IRS that if an earned income tax credit was claimed, even if it was electronically filed, it would not be processed in an electronic filing track, but would go into the other tracks. And in fact, she did not receive her refund on that part of the claim or her tax return for over 3 months. The settlement agreement recognized the difference between the two and stated that a refund anticipation loan is sometimes erroneously referred to as a rapid refund. Indeed, Block has been enjoined from using the term rapid refund in connection with a refund anticipation loan, which is a JTH tax case, and which they did repeatedly in their brief in this case. Further, as part of the settlement agreement required that an amended complaint be filed. Prior to its filing, when Block's attorney, Ms. Ellingsworth, still attempting to confuse rapid refund anticipation loans.
What relief does the settlement give to your clients, the rapid refund people?
Nothing. Absolutely. They get absolutely zilch for their rapid refund claim.
I really should have asked you the question that I asked Mr. Kirby.
That's correct, and I believe I answered it, but if I did not, go on.
Okay. How is the fee structure completely different?
Block has different fee programs, and each fee program is broken down into different components. They have a separate charge for refund anticipation loans, and another separate charge for rapid refunds, and another separate charge for preparing the tax return. So under the fee structure, if they are going to receive an electronic filing for a rapid refund, they have a separate charge for that. If they are going to get a refund anticipation loan, there is a separate charge for that. So even blocking it, fee structure separates the two.
So the rapid refund could not, in your view, ever be viewed as related in any way to the charge, to the fees that are charged for the RAO.
That is correct. That is recognized by the settlement agreement. That is recognized by court opinions that have found it's a deceptive practice for Block to combine the two. They are two separate items. And none of the named plaintiffs in this case had a rapid refund which was going to be delayed for an earned income tax credit on that particular return. So none of the named plaintiffs could bring the claim that Peterson brought and is pending as a certified class in state court. All of the plaintiffs, the amended complaint that was required to be filed specifically excludes the Peterson claims from the release by name. All of the plaintiff's attorneys, in some manner or another, have stated they do not think that the Peterson claims are included within the release. And I think that if they are included in the release, then the plaintiff's attorneys have effectively defined themselves as having inadequately represented them. They disclaim any effort to obtain anything for the Peterson Rapid Refund claims. And we
were the summary judgment before Judge Castillo, was there not?
Yes.
What did that involve specifically?
That involved a RICO claim involving the Rapid Refund. When he granted summary judgment on the RICO claim, he then dismissed the remaining state court claims, which are breach of contract, Consumer Fraud Act, and restitution, which are pending in the state court, and Judge Durkin in the state court has denied summary judgment to block on those claims, and it's set for trial if this court reverses. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. LaTurner. Mr. Angstreich?
May it please the court, Stephen Angstreich for Mrs. Gerald Mitchell. There are two points that I want to start with that deal with matters that Mr. Kirby mentioned. The question of Dr. Adler, the expert, it was not an affidavit, it was a narrative. There was never any sworn presentation to the court by way of an affidavit.
But did the district court deny you, did you request another opportunity to depose Dr. Adler after he returned from the hospital?
Your Honor, my recollection is that there was a request made during the proceeding for a delay because of that, and it was denied. The reality was that we made a position known to the court that there was no admissible evidence. This goes to the clear adequacy of the representation that relates to the matter here. The entire discussion of the settlement began with a settlement between counsel and beneficial. H&R Block and the Block defendants were not party to that discussion. They were not within the ambit of it. The $20 to $25 million discussion, as testified to by Mr. Harris, only related to beneficial. It was later on, after everything is allegedly worked out, that the plaintiff's attorneys are told H&R Block and the Block defendants are going to be part of this settlement. There is some issue as to how much they got to allow Block to be released. In Mrs. Schwartz's brief filed in this court in connection with the fee dispute, she makes it clear that $20 million of the settlement was on the table and that in order for Block to walk away, they had to put up $5 million. That was the adequacy of the settlement that we attempted to demonstrate to the court. Whatever beneficial's role might have been, you have to focus in on H&R Block. H&R Block, according to the evidence that was presented, did 25 million refund anticipation loans. Not all of them with beneficial. 5 million of those loans were done with other lending institutions. People who had refund anticipation loans, such as Mrs. Mitchell with Mellon Bank, did not sue beneficial because her loan was not through beneficial. Those claims, those people who had rapid refunds or refund anticipation loans, which comes under the trademark of rapid refunds, with those other institutions were also placed into this. Adequacy of representation, the attorneys for these plaintiffs stood up in court and said to Judge Zagel, there is no claim against H&R Block. There never was a claim against H&R Block. We don't think that there is a claim. How you could be an adequate representative of a class of plaintiffs who have sued H&R Block in Texas, in Pennsylvania, in Maryland, in Tennessee, in Alabama, as Mrs. Mitchell, for breach of fiduciary duty, for a violation of their agency role, for unfair and deceptive trade practices, stand in front of a court and say that they adequately represented these people and got the most they possibly could when they disavowed any claim. These are the same individuals who never took a deposition, never read a document from H&R Block, never did any investigation of H&R Block until allegedly the confirmatory discovery period, and then according to Mrs. Schwartz again in her brief, none of them read those documents either. Yet Judge Rizzi stood up before Judge Daigle and said there's no case, there never could be a case, and this is a waste of everybody's time. This is a very unusual situation because the advocates of the litigation, those people that took the depositions, those people that examined the documents, Mr. Karstarfin, Mr. Kirby, myself, who came to object, are not the kind of objectors that this court and other courts see in class settlements. Those people who come before the court to ask for an enhancement and then seek a fee. We were the advocates for this. The class was totally disarmed.
Your group are the Alabama plaintiffs, aren't they?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, what do you think is your strongest claim?
There are two claims, Your Honor. There's a claim that Block is the agent of the taxpayer client. That is a theory.
Fiduciary.
Well, it's sometimes yes, sometimes no. There's a confidential relationship theory, which the Intermediate Appellate Court in Pennsylvania has said exists. There is the agency relationship that the highest court in Maryland has said can exist and go forward with. There's a fiduciary duty claim that the court in Texas and Hazi said can go forward. Coupled with those, you have the unfair and deceptive trade practice claim because there are two fees that Block collects. The euphemistic license fee, which has otherwise been called a kickback, and the sharing of the loan arrangement.
But isn't there a cap on the damages you can get under that statute?
The unfair and deceptive trade practice? Well, no. What some of the statutes are the greater of, so that some plaintiffs have an opportunity, as we showed Judge Daigle with a chart, every state that has a greater of the particular number in the statute or your actual damages are greater than the award that you can get from this settlement.
In Alabama, it's what,
$100? $100, Your Honor, yes.
But your opponents say that doesn't apply to class action.
That's the argument.
Any law on that?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. It is not by the statute. If not Alabama, there are other states in which that minimum does permit it, as in Pennsylvania. So there are.
Do you have clients outside of Alabama?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not just Alabama.
We represent the plaintiff in the Basile litigation, the plaintiff Green in the Maryland litigation, which was a certified class that went up to the highest court in Maryland. And Maryland found that an agency relationship can exist under the facts presented. We had cases in Tennessee and Louisiana that all got delayed except for Basile. Basile was carved out of the settlement. So then that case is still pending.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask one?
Yes,
sir. You said that there was a request made to hold up the proceeding until you could depose Adler. Is that correct?
That's my recollection. The issue.
You don't have any record site for that.
I don't have a record site handy, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Van Tine?
Good morning, Your Honors. If I could first respond to a couple of points that Mr. Angstreich was addressing. First, in regards to Dr. Adler, the fact of the matter is...
Who is he, by the way? Is he a lawyer or what?
No, he is an accountant with a PhD, a certified fraud examiner. He has teaching credentials. He is a former partner at Altshuler, Melvoin & Glasser.
Well, how does an accountant value a lawsuit? Depends on the strength of the legal claim, doesn't it? He wouldn't know anything about that, would he?
No, he would not, and I do not believe that he was addressing the strength of the legal claims. I think that he was trying to assess the economic value.
Well, how can you do that? It depends on the legal claims.
Well, that is correct. I think that he was trying to look at the evidence and look at it the way an accountant would to try to assess the value.
I don't understand that. I mean, if they have, suppose they have a substantial fraud claim against H&R Block or Beneficial or both, How could an accountant value that?
Well, an accountant could review the evidence to see if he found support for it. He is a fraud.
An accountant is acting as a judge?
No, he is not acting as a judge, Your Honor.
Well, how do judges evaluate evidence? How do accountants evaluate evidence?
Well, he is a certified fraud.
I don't understand what he's doing.
Other than the reports from Dr. Adler, what evidence did you submit to the court to demonstrate the adequacy of the settlement?
We submitted affidavits from the attorneys. The court had previously received evidence in connection with the preliminary settlement approval hearing. There was evidence that accompanied the draft of Dr. Adler's report at that time, which was produced by the parties. But this was primarily something that was based upon the law and the history of the litigation, coupled with the evaluation by the attorneys and Dr. Adler.
Do you recall the appellant requesting that Dr. Adler be made available after he was released from the hospital?
No, I do not. That did not happen. I actually had expected that that might happen. And I hesitate to go outside the record, but I could add to that.
Don't go outside the record. Okay. Thank you.
Wasn't Adler's statement mainly directed to the issue of damages?
Yes.
Wasn't he evaluating?
Yes, he was.
Certain things of damages?
Yes, he was.
Wasn't it only damages?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Of course, you do have, it's like the difference between procedural and substantive unconscionability. Who knows whether the $25 million is adequate? But the circumstances of the settlement and the casualness with which Judge Daigle seems to have treated this whole business, I find extremely disturbing. I don't understand how you can have settlement negotiations with someone who doesn't have a suit.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that...
Well, you go to a person and say, please sue me. I know you have a case against me, but I'd really like to settle with you and extinguish 100 other cases at the same time.
Your Honor, I believe...
The travesty of the legal process.
Your Honor, I believe that the evidence clearly shows that that did not happen and that that's what Judge Daigle found, that that finding is entitled to deference.
What finding is entitled to deference?
That there was no settlement of this case at the Metropolitan Club, that there was no collusive settlement in this case. I mean, the timeline which Judge Daigle focused on illustrates that vividly. Whatever the he said, she said of what happened at the Metropolitan Club, you have a case where...
I understand. Beneficial meets with these people who don't even have a case, and they talk about this, $20 million or $25 million, and lo and behold, a few years later, there it is. There's the settlement in just that range.
But first, the evidence...
Sleeping in H&R Block, even though H&R Block seems to potentially liable for fraud?
First, the evidence is disputed that a $20 to $25 million statement was made.
Well, the judge did make a finding on this?
He made a finding that he did not believe that it was said. He mentioned the conflicting evidence in his opinion.
Well, did he resolve this conflict?
I believe that he resolved it, that it had not been said.
Of course it had not been settled. Did he resolve it?
No, it had not been said, Your Honor.
Those numbers had not been mentioned? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Where did Judge Daigle find that?
His statements regarding that were in his opinion issued toward the end of July 2000, which found that the class could be certified for settlement but rejected the settlement as preferred because of the reversion. Mm-hmm. But if that had happened, if there was a settlement at that time in September, if the defendants were so anxious to get this done because they were worried about all these other cases, if the plaintiffs were just greedy lawyers looking for this money, why didn't they file suit the next day? Why did it take 25 months to bring the settlement before the court? Why didn't they file suit the next day? Why did it take them seven months?
Why didn't they file the suit the next day?
Because there was no settlement. It had been rejected. They also just did not think that they had to bring suit. They were clearly interested.
I don't understand. Didn't have to bring a suit?
Not that they did not have to bring a suit, but that there was no time pressure on them to bring a suit. There was no settlement. Any question of that had been rejected.
Mr. Zantine, do you dispute that the settlement amounts did not increase in exchange for releasing Block as well?
I do dispute that because I think that the history of the settlement negotiations laid out in the briefs demonstrates that between January and February of 1999, when any serious settlement negotiations began, and October of 1999, when the deal was concluded, the proposals consistently got higher. Moreover, I think it's indisputable that Block is entangled in these refund anticipation loans to a great degree. It is not surprising that Beneficial and Block, which, as some of the parties have stated, have complex financial arrangements between them, would want to have both parties involved. But that's another point which refutes this collusion argument.
I'd like to go back to this July opinion of Judge Nagel. I don't think he represented accurately what he said. That Harris believes he heard Rublin say the current case was worth $23 or $24 million. Both Rublin and Aducci deny ever throwing out any number. In the very least, it is clear that Lunch left Harris with the belief that national class actions could be brought and settled for somewhere around $24 million. Now, I don't see any finding there that these numbers were not discussed.
If I overstated that, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think that if we look at the history of this litigation throughout.
Harris's testimony that Rublin threw out a number for purposes of illustration of 24 or 23 million is credible. That seems to me the opposite of what you said.
Okay, if I overstated that, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Why did you say the opposite, actually? We won't quarrel over that.
But, Your Honor.
And I don't understand the sweeping in of this Texas suit, and I don't get it. Why would you want to sweep in the Texas suit? Because a different party, H&R Block, involves Texas law. It's proceeding in Texas. It seems to be doing well. And it gets swept into Chicago and gets extinguished.
Well,
what's that about?
Your Honor, during the settlement negotiations, the plaintiff did seek to carve out a number of states, Pennsylvania, New York, Maryland, and Texas. And there were hard-fought adversarial negotiations here. As it was, we were able to negotiate Pennsylvania being cut out to the degree that it was, but we were not able to...
But you got nothing because back at the Metropolitan Club, when H&R Block wasn't even in there, it looked like you could get between 20 and 25 million, and that's where the thing ends up, and with all these other suits extinguished.
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that a great deal was gotten during the settlement negotiation.
I don't think anything was gotten. What was gotten?
During the period between January or February of 1999 and October of 1999, the amount being discussed and being offered in settlement progressively increased, both in amount and in terms of the cash proportion of it. At one point, a coupon settlement was being discussed. We ended up with a $25 million all-cash settlement with attorney's fees in addition to that.
Of course, you were prepared to do it with a reversion, which might have, of course, yielded much less.
Well, that is correct, but that was one of the negotiation points. My firm...
You so flaxed your negotiations.
Excuse me?
You so flaxed. I'm happy to let them have the reversion.
We were not happy. In particular, the representatives of my firm strongly opposed that. That is in the record.
Well, wasn't opposed before Judge Daigle. It was Judge Daigle's own idea to...
Well, but that, Your Honor, sometimes when you're negotiating, things come up that seem to be deal breakers. You have to fight hard to get the best deal that you can. You always strive to get more. And I would represent that that's exactly what...
Well, obviously it wasn't a deal breaker.
Well, at that point, things had changed. We were many months down the road, almost a year. Millions of dollars had been spent on notice to the class. Notices had been gone out. The defendants may have felt that there would be public relations problems. The defendants may have changed their opinions about how much they wanted to settle the case at that time. That this was October of 1999 versus a change negotiated in August of 2000.
Your opponents say the reason for excluding the Pennsylvania lawsuit was because a Block or a Beneficial or both wanted to get the appellate court decision there reversed of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And I don't see in your brief that you responded to that point. Did you have any response to it?
I do not know what was in Block's mind when they agreed to a particular thing during negotiation.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.